This is the second day of this August 2011 two-day sesshin. And today I'm going to talk about a couple of things. One is the extinction of suffering. The Buddha said, "But I teach but two things, suffering and the extinction of suffering." In the course of the last 10 years or so, and in the course of this sesshin, I've run into some situations where I've pointed out to people the need to accept pain. How can this fit with the extinction of suffering? The acceptance of pain means that it can pass through. But this is something that does not come easily to us. The usual thing when we are insulted, even in some small way by another person, we react. We don't see this in ourselves, but the reason we react and fight back, or there's retribution, or we go through thoughts of retribution of some kind or another, is that we are unable to accept this pain. This is not usually elucidated as a fundamental Zen teaching, but in fact, if you look carefully, it is a very important Zen teaching, and especially with regard to making moving along the path, working with a teacher. This is, for me, this picture of Jesus with the heart where the thorns are around it, the only thing that's ever meant to me is that somehow this person could accept pain. And then I think, too, of Nelson Mandela in years of prison. They tried to make him into a hater, and they couldn't. Why is that? I think it has to be that he learned or unlearned his reactions and was able to accept pain. This is maybe one of the most important spiritual lessons in life. I think of situations between couples where it goes back and forth, little jabs, little stuff, and one person gives this little jab, and you get into this monumental entanglement with one another, each person causing the other pain, and finally a relationship blows apart. It's because each party cannot accept the pain and stop it. Now, acceptance of pain doesn't mean you just take it. Acceptance of pain can also mean that you feel the pain and you tell the other person about it. We usually want to keep this hidden, that we're feeling pain. We want to pretend that we haven't been affected by some jab or some, and so we don't tell them. But very often it's important to be completely honest, say, "Wow, that really hurt." This is the way it can pass through. This is the road to freedom. Ironically, this is the road to freedom from suffering, the ability to accept pain. This is the road to ego attrition. This is the way to ego desiccation and ultimately ego extinction. Actually, the way to accept pain is often simply to say to oneself, when one's feeling this, I feel pain. Usually what's happening is we're thinking of retribution of some sort, and we don't see clearly that we're feeling pain. And so we're thinking of this retribution, but just stop for a minute. Stop for a minute and look at what you're feeling. It's pain. And you're fighting it. That's what all these thoughts are about. As soon as you really see that it's pain, then the thoughts will cease. Well, cease to some extent. Nothing's ever quite black and white. Actually, when there's been some big difficulty, it can take, this works really well with Zen practice. If you can get yourself into a really concentrated state of mind, determined not to let the thoughts of retribution and anger go on, recognizing them, but determined to move through the pain, then you can do it. I'm not sure that it's something that would work well without Zen practice. I'm not sure that you could tell this to a person that didn't practice and that it would mean anything, because they're not used to looking inward and seeing what's going on. The truth is that all this stuff about accepting pain also applies to accepting whatever feeling you're having. If you are not recognizing the feeling, not fully experiencing it, then you very likely will be intellectualizing. The way to cut intellectualizing is to feel the feeling fully. And then you pass through. Today, just for a change, I'm a Zen person. I love the simplicity of Zen, the simplicity of the practice, the with no great need for studying, intellectual studying. But there's another way, and I'm going to be reading from Being Dharma by Achan Chan. Achan Cha was a Thai teacher in northeastern Thailand. I first heard of him when living in Laos in the mid to late 70s. By then he was quite famous. A very simple monk, simple but deeply enlightened monk. Achan Cha was never after fame. But here's a little bit. More than 1 million people, including the Thai royal family, attended Achan Cha's funeral in 1992. He left behind a legacy of Dharma talks, students, and monasteries. So I didn't get far enough with this to really read directly from his teachings. What I found was very inspiring, and that's why I'm going into this, was simply the introduction and the translator's introduction. The foreword is by Jack Kornfield. And the translator's preface is by the translator. Okay. So, a little light on the subject here. When the first Western disciples arrived at Wat Pop Hong in the 1960s, Achan Cha did not give them special admiration and treatment that Western monks often received in Thailand. He did not excuse any of them from demanding challenges and strict training of the monastery. Seated on a wooden bench at the foot of his cottage in the center of a huge forest, he peered at them like a watchmaker taking off the cover of an intriguing new piece, and demanded to know whether they understood suffering or how to find peace in this world. Then he would laugh in welcome and bid them to listen, and if they dared, to join him in practice for a while. In those years, the monastic community was relatively small, and Achan Chan was still unknown as a teacher. 25 years later, he had become one of the most honored and revered forced masters of the century, and in 1993, nearly a million people joined the Queen of Thailand at his funeral in order to pay their last respects at his temple. By then, his influence had spread worldwide, with 100 branch monasteries and respected disciples teaching internationally. Achan Cha's natural wisdom expressed itself in the wide range of skillful means he used to bring students to freedom. The demanding discipline and mindful dignity of the monastery were his first line of practice. In community, he also taught by anecdote and example, by story, and piercing koan-like questioning. This guy really, as a teacher, was very Zen. The truth of enlightenment makes all these great masters very similar, really. He used humor and poked fun at the delusions of the world and those he mentored. He taught by close-knit relationship, by compassionate understanding, and insightful, no-holds-barred dialogue. Though his way of practice involved strict training of virtue, precepts, renunciation, and concentration, he taught them with a light heart, and all were done in the service of wisdom and freedom. From the start, his teaching of meditation focused on this freedom. While he instructed students in many traditional practices of mindfulness and concentration, he deliberately chose not to emphasize remarkable meditation experiences, samadhi, jhana, or special insight stages. Meditation was a tool, a means to sit and examine ourselves, to quiet the mind and open the heart. He instructed students, quote, to abide in the one who knows, unquote, to discover the natural peace within. From a base of inner stillness, he pointed out, we can more directly see the truth, the way things are. Recognize that? We can recognize the impermanent, ungraspable nature of life. We can study suffering, its cause, and its end. He taught that meditation is a way for us to let go, to stop the war, to put down the struggle, to be at peace no matter what the circumstances. Each day the monastery had periods of chanting and mindful work, walking and sitting meditation, silence and community practice, all interspersed with informal guidance from the master. On occasion, usually after an evening chanting, Achan Cha would close his eyes and give a more extensive Dharma talk, instructions to his monks, nuns, and other devoted disciples. These discourses could last from 1 to 5 hours. The new monks would call the longer ones endurance sessions. Now, Paul Breiter, a longtime student and beloved disciple of Achan Cha, has translated, here's the translator, some of these discourses from Thai and Lao for Western readers. It's a blessing to have these teachings, the meat and potatoes of Achan Cha's Dharma, the evening trainings where he would take the gloves off and challenge us to look squarely at human life. As you read these pages, you can imagine yourself deep in the forest in the early evening after 2 hours of meditation and sonorous chanting. The light is flickering from the candles. There is a quiet rustling of forest creatures settling down. The evening cicadas are singing. The time has come to reflect on your commitment to a life of wakefulness and truth. Now the master addresses you sincerely, describing the nature of this existence. He knows that you too can awaken. Quote, all situations are uncertain. This is the central truth in this worldly realm. He goes on, live with things as they are. Don't get drunk, carried away, lost in your desires, intoxicated by your situation, by ideas, plans, the way you think things should be. Unquote. He expresses the truth in simple ways. You don't own anything. Even your thoughts and body are not your possessions. They are mostly out of your control. You must care for them with compassion, but all things are subject to the laws of change and not your wishes for them. When you truly understand this, you can be at peace in any surrounding. In speaking to the nuns and monks at his temple, Achan Cha urged them to live up to the nobility of their station, to uphold the monastery's reputation as sincere followers of the Buddha's way. He urged a determination in their practice and a fearless self-honesty. He asked them to reflect, have I truly taken the teachings to heart? Am I willing to remove all forms of greed, hatred, and delusion? To let go, to be free. Do I unwaveringly honor the practice of virtue and compassion, no matter how difficult? Am I one who is easy to speak to, easy to reach, not proud or rigid? Don't take the teachings for granted, he went on. They are not philosophy or ideals. Examine yourself. Examine your mind and heart. Release your entanglement with pleasure and pain and rest in the middle way. The heart of freedom. Let the saffron robes you wear be a banner of the Buddha to demonstrate the living reality of peace and wisdom in the world. When he offered Dharma instructions to lay practitioners, government officials, and military officers who visited, it was also the straight scoop, no holds barred. He didn't go along with superficial practices of devotion and merit-making that were common for lay visitors. He demanded that they embody the Dharma, live with virtue and compassion, purify their hearts, and let go of craving and delusion. These were what he insisted are the true blessings and genuine merit to be found in the Buddha's way. You know, this sounds very similar with lay practitioners, government officials, military officers. It's very similar to the situation in China and Japan, where Zen teachers, as they became famous and renowned for their clarity, drew these people to their temples. We're looking at a situation here that is sort of a situation of really ancient Buddhism. In all his teachings, Achan Cha reminds us that liberation is possible. With sincere intention and diligent effort, each of us can awaken. Each of us can discover the freedom and peace of the Buddha. As you read, take these teachings to heart. Digest them slowly. Let them be an inspiration for inquiry. Notice that. Don't just believe. Let them be an inspiration for inquiry. Let them be medicine for your spirit. Let them be a source of guidance for your unshakable deliverance. May the words of Achan Cha carry the clear light of truth into the world. May they bring blessings and awakening to all who read them. And this was written by Jack Kornfield of the Spirit Rock Center in the year 2000. And this is the translator's preface. Among contemporary Thai Buddhist masters, perhaps none have been as influential with Western students of Dharma as Achan Cha, who lived from 1919 to 1992. That is, he lived only 73 years. In the last 10 years of his life, he was pretty much out of action. One reason for his popularity is certainly the clarity and accessibility of his words to people of widely diverse cultural backgrounds and to followers of different Buddhist lineages. Hopefully some of this will come across in the translation set forth in this book. Luang Por, as he was known to his disciples, could teach using the traditional concepts of Dharma, but he also put the truth into analogies and fables using animals, trees, and the events of everyday living in a way that penetrated the hearts of his listeners. He did so with much warmth and humor and without sacrificing anything in the way of profundity. Simple yet profound has become an overused and hackneyed phrase, but it applies to much of Achan Cha's teaching. Over the course of some 25 years of teaching and training, Achan Cha was able, as his senior Western disciple Achan Sumedho put it, to teach the ideas of Buddhism in a way that even an uneducated rice farmer could understand. Yet he was also able to answer the questions of upper-class Thai people and attract and train skeptical Westerners, many of whom stayed under his guidance for 10 years or more, and still continue the monastic life today. Achan Cha consistently pushed people past what they were likely to consider their limits. Ah, the sign of a good teacher. We have this here, too. The practice in his monasteries did not always follow what might seem to be reasonable, and the routine was always changing. He sometimes recounted his own difficulties in practice and the resolve with which he faced them and spurred himself on. There's a quote from Achan Cha. Before I started to practice, I thought to myself, the Buddhist religion is here, available for all. Yet why do only some people practice it while others don't? Or if they do practice, they do so only for a short while and then give it up. And those who don't give up still don't knuckle down and do the practice. Why is this? So I resolved to myself, okay, I'll give up body and mind for this lifetime and try to follow the teaching of the Buddha down to the last detail. I'll reach understanding in this lifetime, because if I don't, I'll be sunk in suffering. I'll let go of everything else and make a determined effort. No matter how much difficulty or suffering I have to endure, I'll persevere. If I don't do it, I'll just keep on doubting. Thinking like this, I got down to practice. No matter how much difficulty I had to endure, I did it. I looked on my whole life as if it were only one day and a night. I gave it up. I'll follow the teaching of the Buddha. I'll follow the Dharma to understanding why this world is so wretched. I wanted to know. I wanted to see the truth. So I turned to the practice of Dharma. While he was most tolerant of people's shortcomings and limitations, he always wanted his disciples to make as much effort as they possibly could, simply for the goal of escaping from the clutches of Mara, the evil one, who holds us prisoner in this realm of suffering. He did not see this as something easily accomplished. Quote, if practicing Dharma were easy, everyone would be doing it, he often said. But it's really the only thing worth doing with a human life. The worldly way of living generally involves filling life with busyness, distractions, and amusements in an endless pursuit of happiness and an effort to avoid boredom. But a constantly distracted and exciting mind is a tired and worried mind. When a person makes a commitment to undergo Buddhist training, he or she is setting out to free the mind from all such dependence. It can be extremely painful. It can be an extremely painful and frustrating process as accumulated habits, hopes, and fears start to surface in the new open space of non-distraction. Achan Cha pointed out that there are people who think monastic life is some kind of mistake. Escape. There are people who think of monastic life as some kind of escape. But when it is actually undertaken, facing oneself for the first time with nowhere to hide can be like walking into a raging storm. Achan Cha often speaks about heedlessness. By that term, he means a careless, unaware approach to living, and he notes that it is often compounded by comforts. But until one starts to do without such things, these links remain hidden. Soft living tends to make the mind soft. He spoke about the simple way of life in the not-too-distant past in Thailand. Before, when the country was not developed, everyone built their toilet some distance from the house, often in the forest. You had to walk out there to use it. But now the toilet has to be in the house. The city people even have to have it right there where they sleep. Such a concept struck him as funny. Laughing, he said, people think that it will make them more comfortable and happy to have a toilet in their bedroom. But it doesn't really bring happiness. And increases the habit of laziness. His way of training was not meant to be an endurance test, however. When he saw disciples making great efforts in a mindless, mechanical way, he would correct them. And he was never ambiguous about where the emphasis should lie. After the Buddha's years of fruitless asceticism, he came to realize the way to liberation lay in the mind. The body itself was just a material object incapable of enlightenment. It was also not something evil that hindered spiritual development and needed to be tortured or weakened. This is as much a deviation as trying to beautify the body and seek happiness through sensual pleasure and social approval. So the role of asceticism is in creating simplicity and non-involvement in confusion, not deprivation for its own sake. And statements such as destroy your body or destroy the world do not literally refer to suicide or nuclear weapons, but in the context of meditation and Achan Cha's lively ways of teaching, to destroy attachment to these things. One night, Achan Cha was welcoming a former lay patron who had just ordained and came to spend the rains retreat. He gave one of his informal, rambling discourses, putting the Dharma across in recollections and personal observations. He spoke of traveling on Tudong, the traditional ascetic practice of wandering in the countryside and wilderness, seeking solitude in forests and mountains, and visiting spiritual teachers. Sometimes I would walk 40 kilometers in a day. It's not that I was strong, but I had energy of spirit. Even soldiers can't march like that. Some days I would go for alms and get nothing but rice. It was really interesting to watch my mind when I ate. I think, if only I had some salt. Who would imagine that you could gain wisdom from eating plain rice? Achan Cha was not afraid to test the extremes in his own practice, and he saw this experience as instructional for himself. Boy, this is something that we all need to do in Zen practice, in Sesshin, to test the extremes in practice. And there's few of us that can do this very, very often. But it is an inspiration to others if we can. It's not just for ourselves that we might do this. Anyway, such methods can be painful to undergo, but one comes to see where the mind holds on and limits itself, and to see that the real suffering comes from the mind's attachments, fears, and preconceptions. He did not recommend fasting, vows of silence, or avoiding contact with others. He said, "We practice with our eyes open." If avoiding people and sense contact were the way to enlightenment, the blind and the deaf should be enlightened. Wisdom is to be found in the realm of sense contact. The world is transcended by knowing the world, not by avoiding it. Living at close quarters with others in the same routines day after day, which is the way of life in his monasteries, can reveal a lot about one's habits and the way one creates suffering for oneself. He often said, "If it's hot and difficult, that's it. That's the place of practice." This next section is entitled Teaching Dharma. Achan Cha was always available to his disciples for guidance, but he did not conduct frequent interviews to determine their progress. He urged people to self-reliance through knowing their own minds and not getting attached to or doubtful about whatever occurred in meditation. He often told the Sangha that he was giving them a suitable environment in which to develop their own practice. He said, "It's like providing a pasture for your cows. If there's a pasture that's fenced in and has plenty of grass, the cows can eat grass and also be safe. If they are cows, they will eat. If they don't want to eat the grass, they aren't cows. Maybe they're pigs or dogs." His meditation instructions were unusually simple. Concentration and insight are generally not dealt with as separate topics. Mindfulness and insight are threaded through most of the teachings and are spoken of on different levels of refinement. Also, other standard meditations, such as recollection of death and generation of loving kindness, metta, were often not taught systematically or formally, but more as themes for contemplation and as attitudes to be kept constantly in mind. He would present these ideas in ways that pierce the heart. On his visit to the United States in 1979, he established the theme of facing the executioner. Imagine there was a fortune teller whose predictions were always right. You go to see him, and he tells you, "Without question, you are going to die in 7 days. Would you be able to sleep? Would you let go of everything and meditate day and night? In truth, this is what we're all destined for, and we are facing the executioner every moment. And he recommended as homework thinking about one's own death 3 times a day, at the very least. The structure of this book follows Achan Cha's oft-repeated statement. First, one learns Dharma, but does not yet understand it. Then one understands, but has not yet practiced. One practices, but has not seen the truth of Dharma. Then one sees Dharma, but one's being has not yet become Dharma. The point of this classification is that until reaching the level of being Dharma, one still has suffering, and one's potential is not fully realized. Now we are at the stage in the transmission of Buddhism to the West where many people have been sincerely studying and practicing the way of the Buddha for decades. And so this may be a concept that can be understood directly from experience. Achan Cha saw Dharma practice as a way of life and not merely a set of exercises or rituals. And the goal, though he rarely spoke of goals or attainments, has nothing less than the cessation of suffering, a state of clarity and peace in which the mind is no longer swayed by internal and external happenings. It might be helpful to keep in mind when reading the teachings, which are full of repetition of basic themes and may at times appear to be too basic and simplistic. Achan Cha always urged his listeners to neither believe nor disbelieve his words, but rather to investigate the teachings to see how they related to personal experience. And with regard to that pain thing, that's what I would say. Investigate this and see. Don't believe it from me. See what this can do, the true acceptance of pain without lashing out. Achan Cha was primarily a teacher of monks and nuns, people who have forsaken worldly ties and gone forth to a life of renunciation. While he was emphatic that Buddhist practice is not the exclusive province of monastics, he did emphasize the advantages offered by the discipline and simplicity of ordained life. Living in a monastery that is following the canonical discipline, one refrains from all harm. There is a community based on mutual helping, sharing, and respect. With minimal possessions, there is little to squabble over or covet. Dharma is something to be lived, an idea reflected in Thai words for spiritual practice. And living in this way for a number of years builds habits of attentiveness, restraint, and unselfishness. The result is often people who are strikingly happy. Sometimes Achan Cha may sound moralistic to Western ears in talking about things such as heedlessness or refraining from evil, for example. The Buddha explained evil as that which harms oneself and others, and he called heedlessness the way to death. Paying attention to the fine details of how one lives in all situations, alone or with others, can refine the mind considerably and create a firm foundation for meditation practice. And, I'll add, meditation practice can lead one to pay attention to the fine details of how one lives in all situations, alone or with others. Talk of good and evil may rankle us due to habit, perhaps the result of too many joyless Sunday school lessons, but it may be worthwhile to think about the implications. Achan Cha speaks repeatedly of the need for moral conduct, but it is for the purpose of creating a relaxed mind and a harmonious living environment, not in response to commandments handed down from high, the violation of which is met with punishment. As with all of his teachings, his instructions on morality and virtue have a practical purpose and do not involve taking anything on blind faith. He also speaks of the necessity of transcending both good and evil, but as in all schools of Buddhism, there is need for close attention to them, not only at first, but most of the way through the path. As in the original teachings of the Buddha, repetition is common in Achan Cha's words. The need to drive a point home cannot be underestimated, especially with the precious Dharma that contradicts habitual thinking so deeply rooted in worldly beings. Again, we can ask ourselves, how thoroughly have we understood and assimilated into our being these seemingly simple ideas? Achan Cha was something of a reformer in Thai Buddhism. Like the Buddha, he taught in the vernacular and cut through stultified traditions of his time. He was just as likely to use analogies to dogs, mangoes, chickens, rice fields, and buffaloes as he was to employ the classic Buddhist terminology he had studied before taking up the way of an ascetic meditation monk. In keeping up with his view that the Dharma teaching is a matter of skillful means to make people see, he often said that one who teaches needs to know what is appropriate for those who are listening. He also rejected the sectarianism that sometimes poisons relations between the two main monastic groups in Thailand. His teachings return again and again to the themes of cause and effect, impermanence, non-attachment, moral living, avoiding extremes, and not taking things too seriously. When you're reading that sentence, the last part comes as a little bit of a surprise. And not taking things too seriously. Occasionally, Achan Cha offered glimpses of the other shore, of the experience of one who has gone beyond the mundane. But for the most part, he dealt with the problems we face and the ways the Buddha taught for dealing with and putting an end to them. He compared speaking extensively about nirvana, the deathless state of bliss, to explaining colors to a blind person, and noted that people in the Buddha's time complained that the world honored one must be ignorant of nirvana, since he did not explain clearly what it was. Achan Cha often quotes the Pali term pakatam, or something like that, which means the results of practice are to be experienced for oneself and cannot be given by another or understood through mere explanation. Occasionally, Achan Cha spoke of the unconditioned, of the original mind, of that which is beyond birth and death, and he seemed to get a great kick out of doing so. Hearing the Heart Sutra in rough translation from English to Thai, he remarked that it talks of deep wisdom beyond conventions, but this does not mean we can discard conventions. Without conventions, how could we teach, communicate, or explain anything? In the end, his concern was to train, not to entertain, to help purify people's obscurations so they could directly see directly, just as one tries to cure a blind person's malady rather than merely talking to him about colors. Just as one tries to cure a blind person's problem rather than talking merely about colors. As the Buddha said, I teach only two things, namely suffering and the end to suffering. Right view is mentioned repeatedly. Achan Cha called it the foundation of the path, along with sila, moral conduct. And it is indeed the first factor in the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It is meant in both an intellectual and an experiential sense, the latter being what is also called wisdom. Briefly, Ajahn Chah speaks of right view as understanding cause and effect, not holding things to be stable or permanent or sure, seeing the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence, and not believing in the existence of a self. On the side of experience, it is a mode of being in which one does not react to internal and external phenomena with elation or depression, seeing them for what they actually are, and thus not suffering. Not suffering, in quotation marks, is not a blank state, but one of peace, radiance, and joy, which is what most people who met him saw very strikingly in Ajahn Chah. This should be kept in mind when reading his description of wisdom and the state of peace as being on beyond happiness or suffering. Obviously, there is great happiness in liberation, but there is nothing in our ordinary experiences of happiness that remotely compares to it, nothing that can be conceived by the confused mind or found through the usual paths of seeking the pleasant and avoiding the unpleasant. Cutting here a bit. Ajahn Chah lived in one of the more remote, unheard-of, and inaccessible corners of Thailand. Yet somehow a steady stream of Western seekers found the way to his monastery, beginning in the late 1960s, and many ended up staying under his guidance for years. This pot-bellied monk, who looked more like a bullfrog than a saint, had an appeal and a way of communicating truth that reached across cultural barriers and the strata of societies. Over the years, he touched many hearts and shaped many lives for the better. In Thailand, it was always striking to see the throngs of people who would turn up even at the most remote monastery he visited. Watching adults coming running from the village like children to meet his car, joyfully calling out Luang Por, was an unforgettable sight. His very being was a refuge to people, each receiving what they could at their own level. Through his vibrant, joyous presence, he instilled an absolute trust and sense of safety. Today in the West, there are monastic communities in his lineage, including a number of monks who had the opportunity to live and train with Ajahn Chah. There are also many former monks and nuns, as well as lay people who spent time with him. Visiting from time to time, one is struck by the great regard in which he is still held, the love and gratitude people feel for him. Some things people say, Luang Por was good, wasn't he? And then, he was the most remarkable person I ever met, and one of the greatest men Thailand has ever produced. Yet this is no mere personality cult of blind devotion. He was always on the alert for disciples who depended on him too much, and he could make one's life miserable if he felt it was needed to get someone out of his or her rut. As he repeats in his teachings, the Buddha did not praise those who blindly follow another without trying to discover the truth for themselves. Well, I didn't get to read all that I thought I might get to read, but I hope that folks have found this as inspiring as I did, and that it can infuse our efforts in this Sesshin and bring people back again and again to this work. We'll now recite the four vows.